Welcome back. You're listening to The Last Savior. We have Dr. Karimi with us, and we are discussing definite signs, and Yamania is one of the definite signs. Or is it a definite or indefinite signs? We're analyzing the narrations. Dr. Karimi, before going to the break, we are having a wave of scholarly debates. You said that there are some scholars who said that there is a possibility to forget the word, which is more likely than adding a word. Mm-hmm. And the word that is being forgotten or that is being added is the word mathuma, that's definite.
Exactly. As I mentioned, according to the scholars who believe that Yamani is not one of the definite signs, in our case, it is possible for the narrator to have added the word mahtumat.
All right.
Because this word has been repeated in the narrations which are related to the signs of the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, the companions of the Imams. They knew about these two categories, mahtum and ghayr mahtum, definite and non-definite. They asked the Imam which sign is definite, which sign is not definite. So when we have such a case in which a word is repeated in such narrations, then it is likely for the narrator to have added the word mahtumat in this narration too. Let me give our dear listeners another example.
All right.
There is a famous narration that la darara wa la darar. There are many discussions about this narration in the books of jurisprudence and principles of jurisprudence. One of the meanings of this narration is that you should not harm other people and you should not permit other people to harm you.
This
is the definition of the narration.
Okay.
Now, another version of this narration is لا ضرر ولا ضرار في الإسلام.
Okay.
في الإسلام is an addition. There is no darar, there is no darar in the religion of Islam.
In the religion.
Now, the question here is that which narration should be preferred, with the addition of fil Islam or without it?
Without it.
As I mentioned, the principle says that the narration with addition should be preferred.
All
so,
right.
La darara wa la darara fil Islam should be preferred.
Preferred, all right.
But here again, a group of scholars like Allama Naini, they believe that no. The narrations which tell us that there is not such a thing is in Islam are a lot. For example, لا رهبانية في الإسلام, لا سرورة في الإسلام, لا إحصاء في الإسلام. Because of the fact that we have a number of such narrations, it is possible for the narrator to have made a mistake here and to have added في الإسلام here too.
All right.
So the point is that when we have a word repeated in some narrations, then it makes it likely for the narrator to have added it in this case too.
All right.
So the conclusion is that we have, two viewpoints here. A group of scholars who consider Yamani as one of the definite signs, they believe that the narration with addition should be preferred.
All
so
right.
The narration reads, خمس علامات محتومات. Five definite signs. So Yamani is one of the definite signs.
All right.
Other group of scholars believe that no, in this case, the narration without addition should be preferred.
All right.
And the third argument is that at the end of the day, we have on one side Al-Kafi and on the other side, we have Kamaluddin. And the famous idea among Shia scholars is that Al-Kafi is the most authentic collection of hadith. So these are three arguments by a group of scholars who believe that Yamani cannot be considered as one of the
definite signs.
And as I mentioned, this is a scholarly discussion. It is open to our dear listeners to have more research on it and to come to their own and final conclusion.
So in belief, we basically have this, that you cannot actually follow it. There's no taqleed, there's no following in belief. So this is a point of belief over here we are discussing. And beliefs are always based upon reasoning. They're always based upon logic. And more research is needed. So it's not necessary that you follow a particular scholar and a particular point of view. You can research a lot. You can go through a lot of debates, articles, a lot of reading and listening to our program, definitely. Thank you so much, Dr. Karimi, for being with us.
My pleasure.
So much for providing the conclusion as well, providing the narrations, providing the chains. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to The Last Savior from IRIB English Radio. In case you want to listen to our programs again, you can go back to our official website, which is parstoday.com. Go to the tab, Call of Islam, and over there you'll find our programs. Thank you so much. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Where is the spring of life? Where is the shining? Midstream.
Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammed Shaya al-Sudani inaugurated the era of his new government with a promise to hold early legislative elections within a year, after amending the electoral law in what appeared to be an effort by him to appease to the Sadr movement, which holds on to the option of taking it back to the streets despite its silence. So far, that Sadrist option represents the main threat to al-Sudani's government, a threat whose possibility is reinforced given the difficulty of the task of combating rampant corruption in the country, which did not witness progress during the reign of the outgoing Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi. In the meantime, the participating parties in the government, especially the coordinating framework and the forces representing the Sunni and Kurdish components, seemed more than satisfied with the launch of the new government. However, no one has illusions that the Sudani government will find solutions to all of Iraq's intractable internal problems, and above them, problems with regional dimensions, especially external interventions. And therefore, the participating forces shed light on one fundamental uplift for it, which is to get the country out of the state of political impasse that continued for a whole year. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Sudani is currently busy trying to solve the Kurdish-Kurdish dispute over the reconstruction and environment portfolios. The Kurdish Union Party demands the Ministry of Environment, while the Democratic Party demands both ministries. These are major differences between the two parties on a number of issues, some of which are related to the internal situation of the Kurdistan region. The legal period for submitting candidates to ministries is 1 month from the date of assigning cabinet. This is what the Iraqi constitution stipulates in Article 76. But there is also a decision by the federal court, which states that postponing votes on some ministries to another period not specified by the decision are still allowed, which the prime minister can later submit to parliament to acquire trust. For now, Prime Minister Sudani's government faces a number of service challenges that trouble the Iraqi street, including addressing the weakness of the electrical sector, repairing the shortage in hospitals and health centers, controlling markets and facing high prices, in addition to addressing the problem of water scarcity, reducing unemployment by creating job opportunities, and encouraging internal and external investments. As for the role of the U.S. in all of the above, considering the delicate stage in which the Iraqi political process is going through, it does not seem that the U.S. administration is far from what is happening. It is following the situation very closely while directing its tools in a way that serves the American strategic goals in Iraq. It remains to be seen if Sudanese government will survive through these so-called U.S. strategies or not. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The new government in Iraq, headed by Prime Minister Mohammed Shaya al-Sudani, obtained the confidence of parliament by an absolute majority after about 2 weeks of assigning al-Sudani the task of forming it, and more than a year during which the country experienced a severe political crisis. With the convening of its first regular session last week, the test of the new government's ability to carry out the main task it has taken upon itself began, especially the struggle against corruption, which requires the will of the participating forces to grant freedom of movement to its prime minister. However, the Iraqi government is missing two ministers dedicated to the Kurds due to a dispute over the division between the Kurdistan Democratic Party and the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, which reflects the first stumbling block for the new prime minister. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Hussein Ibrahim, expert in Iraqi and Persian Gulf political affairs at the Al Akhbar Daily newspaper. Thank you for being with us, Mr. Hussein. Now, Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani pledged to fight corruption that has devastated Iraq and to work to repair ties with the government of the semi-autonomous government or the semi-autonomous regional Kurdistan of Iraq and build an economy that will create jobs and improve public services. This is what he pledged during his statement. Well, him and all the past Iraqi members of parliament have, prime ministers have pledged the same. Is there any difference in what Mr. Shaya al-Sudani has said to his predecessors?
Yes, I do believe that there is a difference in the Iraqi scene in comparison to what it was during the reign of Mustafa Qadimi and during past governments. I think that corruption in Iraq has spread to unprecedented levels, which makes it imperative for Mr. Sudani to work to eliminate corruption. I think he is trying to do so at the moment by firing a lot of public employees who were illegally employed during the government of former PM Qadimi, which happened when this government was a caretaker one. However, the main question remains, will fighting corruption in Iraq touch high-level positions, or will it only be confined to fighting corruption at the basic level? I think that the rooted corruption in Iraq, which has been ongoing for decades now, needs a lot of time to be eliminated, only if there is an actual will to fight it to begin with. Corruption inside Iraq has different faces, yet I believe that the basis of corruption in Iraq goes back to the relationship between high-level Iraqi officials with the US occupation, through which the dirty money flows towards and away from Iraq. This is why even the government of Mr. Sudani includes officials who are actually part of former cabinets and were very much involved in high-level corruption. So the question is, will Sudani be able to fight that level of corruption? I think this question needs some time to be truly answered in Iraq. I think Sudani will start working at the basic level and not the high level.
Well, although we didn't hear Said Muqtada Sadr's opinion about the government, he's not part of the government, he has withdrawn all his members of parliament from the Iraqi parliament, he remains a potent political force with the power to mobilize supporters in the streets, as we saw had happened before in Baghdad and elsewhere in other provinces of Iraq, to create instability for any government that would take the charge in Baghdad, which he is not approving of. He has been clear that he expects early elections. Will Prime Minister Sudani deliver these demands, since it seems that he is eager to get the approval of the Sadr movement, and it's not really clear why?
The Iraqi government already vowed in its initial statement that it will be headed towards an early election within 1 year, while also promised to formulate a new electoral law within 3 months from now. However, the silence of Sayyid Muqtada Sadr has nothing to do with these promises made by PM Sudani. These promises were already in place even before the Sadrist movement took to the streets in the past months. So if it were enough, he wouldn't have asked his followers to hit the streets, which nearly led Iraq to a Shia-Shia civil war. I think that the current international conditions is the main reason behind the formulation of a new government in Iraq, led by PM Sudani. Simply because the world cannot bear another war in Iraq, not even a civil internal one, because it will result in a regional explosion and will also result in a severe increase in oil prices worldwide. Iraq exports 4 million barrels of oil per day. If you add that to the current sanctions against Russian oil, then the global oil market will be hit by severe blow, leading to an insane increase in oil prices, pushing global inflation even further. Hence, I believe that it was the current international conditions that led to the formation of the current Iraqi government. As we know, the political factions which have made up the current Iraqi cabinet have different international loyalties. Hence, these international countries that have direct impact on Iraq, one of which is the USA, demanded from its loyalists to accept the formation of this new government and give it trust and approval. Hence, Sayyid Muqtada Sadr cannot stand in the face of this government on his own, no matter his party's power. In the end, he only got 73 MPs in the Iraqi parliament, which is less than a quarter of the Iraqi parliament. Hence, on his own, he has no majority or power to attain political gains or block the work of the current government on his own without being allied with other political blocs.
But let's say there was some sort of an electoral change, amendment to the electoral law at the parliament, and Sayyid Muqtada Sadr doesn't like that kind of amendment. He didn't like the new law. What are the coordination coalition?
Currently, there is no ground for a civil war or internal warring inside Iraq. If the conditions were readily available with parties who were strong enough to initiate a fight, then any clash would have taken the country to a civil war. However, last August, Iraq witnessed risky clashes that resulted in 50 deaths in the Green Zone. After which the Iraqi political blocs, including the Sadrist movement, took a step back away from internal warring. If a civil war was to take place in Iraq, then August would have been the perfect month to do so. But these specific incidents during the August clashes shows that conditions are not ripe in the region and international arena for a civil war in Iraq. A civil war, as we know, especially in a country like Iraq, a country that undergoes many foreign interventions and has vast borders with many Arab countries like the Persian Gulf Arab states. Knowing that the Persian Gulf Arab states actually pushed for a civil war in Iraq, but failed because simply the world is currently not ready for an Iraqi civil war. Even Sayyid Muqtada Sadr himself does not want to see Iraq falling into a civil war. However, he did possess many pressuring tools that were stripped from him in the recent political wave in Iraq.
It remains to be seen how the Iraqi political scene will be played by the opposing parties after the formation of this new government led by Mr. Shaya Sudani. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Hussein Ibrahim, expert in Iraqi and Persian Gulf political affairs at the Al-Akhbar daily newspaper, for joining us. Thank you very much for your contribution. Now, please stay tuned, because next we are going to talk about the presidential and governmental void in Lebanon.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Lebanese President Michel Aoun concluded his six-year presidential term last week, leaving no successor to replace him. This followed his announcement that he had accepted the resignation of the current caretaker government led by Prime Minister Najib Mikati, who failed to form a government after the elections in May of this year. Amid the constitutional chaos in Lebanon that the country is actually living through today, there are those who claim that Mikati's caretaker government will be unable to manage the affairs of the country. However, what the country needs now is to put the constitutional process on the right track, avoid political outbursts and slander, and elect a president of the republic, and then form a real government with full powers to organize public institutions in Lebanon. Lebanon back to political void in this following report.
Lebanon sank further into acute economic crisis as President Michel Aoun's term of office ended on October 31st. Parliament members began the process of electing his successor on September 29. The political tug-of-war over this post, reserved for a member of the Maronite Christian community, is expected to be lengthy. During the last presidential election, Lebanon went without a president for 29 months. The Lebanese parliament's 128 members of parliament have the constitutional power to elect the head of state. Voting is usually conducted by a secret ballot, and the president of the republic is elected by a two-thirds majority in the first round and by an absolute majority in subsequent rounds. Unsurprisingly, the parliamentary sessions so far were not a success. No consensus has yet been found on who should be Aoun's successor due to the divisions within the political class. Parliament is so polarized that it can't even agree on the need to form a new government to replace the one currently led by incumbent Prime Minister Najib Mikati, who has been in charge of current affairs since May, when the new parliament's mandate began. The country's constitution states that if an election is not held within the last 10 days of the incumbent's mandate, parliament can no longer legislate because it must only hold presidential sessions. The Lebanese, who are already facing the worst economic crisis in the country's history, already know that the presidential process can last a long time. Due to the lack of consensus between the different political camps and various political blockages, they endured 29 months of institutional vacuum after former President Michel Sleiman's term in office ended on May 25, 2014. The main question in Lebanon today is which Maronite is going to be the president? And most relevant for gaining the support of parliamentarians, what political affiliation will the new president have? This kind of political deadlock is not a rare situation for Lebanon. The country is used to having vacuums in power. However, this time people care more about their daily living rather than about which Maronite will be named president. This vacuum finds Lebanon amid economic, financial, and political crises. And with the winter coming and the current energy crisis, the situation will most likely worsen. The stresses of the day-to-day living take people's minds off politics. The living standards are going down, and little do the Lebanese care if there is a government or not, as long as they can have their daily life dealt with, especially that bread, gas, and the basic commodities are now considered a luxury. Even if the caretaker government tries its best to fill the current political vacuum, it is still unauthorized to take the major important decisions that the Lebanese people desperately need now to overcome the current crisis.
Now, to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Jamal Wakim, author and academic and political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us. Dr. Wakim, now, unsurprisingly, the parliamentary sessions to elect a president were so far not successful in Lebanon. No consensus has yet been found on who should be Aoun's successor due to the divisions within the different political classes in Lebanon. How much time do you think it will take to agree on a new president for the Lebanese public? And who are the most prominent candidates in your opinion?
Well, I believe that we might live under a vacuum for several months, if not years, especially with the insistence of some candidates on running, despite the fact that they do not have the possibility to have the majority or to have quorum. The problem lies in the fact that two contenders to the presidency are allies to Hezbollah, i.e. Sleiman Frangieh on one hand and Jibran Bessil on the other hand. And too bad no one of these candidates is willing to step down for the other because both insist on being presidents. It is noteworthy that 6 years ago, when Aoun was running for president, Sleiman Frangieh, the deal was that Sleiman Frangieh would step down on condition that he will be the next president after the end of Michel Aoun's term. But now that Michel Aoun ended his term, Jibran Bessil, the son-in-law of Michel Aoun and head of the Free Patriotic Movement, insisted on being himself a candidate, noting that he is unlikely to have a quorum in the parliament because more than one-third are for the opposition or for the bloc that opposes Jibran Bessil's candidacy. I mean here the Falange Party, the Lebanese Forces, and the Change members of parliament. Whereas with regards to, and it, added to this, Jibran Bessil has the hostility of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia
and the Amal movement in Lebanon.
And the Amal movement, which
basically
both will not vote for him. Yeah, which both will not vote for him. Or let's say in the case of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, it could influence some blocs in the opposition to vote for Sleiman Frangieh, mm-hmm. as Sleiman Frangieh has contacts with Saudi Arabia, unlike the case of Jibran Bessil. Mm-hmm. So this is the real crisis so far. And added to this crisis, I believe that the regional and international atmosphere is unlikely to lead to a compromise in Lebanon as there is a standoff between the United States on one hand and Iran on the other hand.
Well, amid this political deadlock, the Saudi embassy in Lebanon commemorated the 33rd anniversary of the signing of the Taif Agreement. I really didn't know that we celebrated that, but anyways, They commemorated it with the participation of the caretaker Prime Minister Najib Miqati and current and former Lebanese officials, while significant parliamentarian blocs were absent from that meeting. What is Saudi Arabia trying to say after it had abandoned Lebanon and maybe or Lebanese politics in general, especially after they kidnapped the then Prime Minister Saad Hariri in 2017?
Well, I believe that this whole scene that we saw on Saturday was an absurd scene because for too many reasons. First, the Taif agreement was in reality an agreement between Saudi Arabia, Syria, and the United States of America. Now that Syria is out of the agreement, so the agreement itself
is void,
yes. In addition, the agreement had a key player at the time, which was Hariri senior, Rafiq Hariri. And Saudi Arabia has chosen to eliminate his son, Saad Hariri, alongside the whole legacy of the Hariri family. So this is another step that makes the agreement void. It's noteworthy that the majority of the Lebanese, let's say, factions, or the representatives of the Lebanese factions, the majority of them were present in the ceremony except for the Shia. And this leads us to conclude that it was a gathering against the Shia sect in Lebanon, which would lead to conflict in the country. I believe that the move by the Ambassador Bukhari was to hide the too many failures that he faced in Lebanon in the past few years, despite his continuous attempts to achieve or make an achievement against Hezbollah, against the bloc that is anti-US, anti-Saudi Arabia in Lebanon. And this is why we had this, let's say, ceremony.
But ever since the Taif agreement was reached, the 128 parliament seats have been divided equally between Muslims and Christians. And within these two dominational blocs, the number of parliament members is determined based on their community's demographic weight. For example, the Shi'at have 27, the Maronites have 34 members in parliament. This was decided during the last census, which was carried out in 1932. Yeah. In Lebanon. Does Lebanon need a new Taif agreement, this time possibly a strictly internal one, or rather a whole new constitution?
Well, too bad. The Lebanese system, the confessional system, has led the country to be, let's say, a reflection of regional and international influence. And in order to end this and to have a full local deal, without foreign intervention, I believe that we need to end this confessional formula and head towards a civil state in Lebanon, which is unlikely in the near future, too bad, because we don't have alternative forces that could lead the country towards a civil society. And in case we have a civil society, so the representatives in the parliament will no longer be considered or appointed because of them being Shia, Sunni, or Christians, but because they really represent the whole country with disregard to the confessional division in the country. Mm-hmm. So, but too bad, this is a sort of utopia for the time being. It's a dream that will never be achieved anytime soon.
So what we get from your answers here, Dr. Jamal, is Lebanon is going into a deep state of political void, possibly for the upcoming year or more.
Well, too bad, yeah.
I want to thank you very much, Dr. Jamal Wakim, author and academic and political commentator, for joining us. Thank you very much for your contribution. Thank you. See you next week.
علم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است. Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned. In today's secular world, if a woman wants to be chaste, she is called backward. In other words, a good woman is one who has open relations with others. Once, one of my friends who is living in a non-Muslim land was invited to the school of his girl. The principal of the school asked him whether his girl has a psychological problem or not. Totally shocked, he asks the principal, why? And the principal answers, because his girl has no relation with the boys. In other words, chastity and saving the honor is considered as a sign of depression in Western world, and this is shocking.
فقط ارزش‌های اخلاقی رو دارن عوض می‌کنن بلکه تو اون فرهنگ شیطانی مادی
Not only the moral values are lost in the capital liberal world but also the identity of the women is changed. The women regret being a woman and it is a disgrace for them. Being a spouse or a wife is considered a lower status for women in the Western world. And this is an absolute disobedience towards Allah. The talents and potentials that are in women are created by Allah, and they can't be changed. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website parstoday.com/en Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Climate emergency is just a rhetoric by Western regimes. This claim is evidenced by these regimes' disregard for the climate emergency and warnings against fossil fuel exploration. In a new move, the UK has opened up a new licensing round to allow oil and gas companies to explore for fossil fuels in the North Sea despite threats of a legal battle from climate campaigners. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media websites for further details. Stay tuned, please. The website of Common Dreams wrote, climate campaigners have recently condemned the UK's announcement that it will open up a new licensing round for oil and gas fields in the North Sea, saying the decision signifies the Conservative government's blatant disregard for the climate emergency and warnings against fossil fuel exploration from energy experts and scientists. Claiming new oil and gas drilling will not undermine the country's stated plan to cut its carbon emissions to net zero by 2050. The North Sea Transition Authority, NSTA, said it will issue up to 100 licenses for nearly 900 exploration areas, including several that are known to contain hydrocarbons. In response to Climate Minister Graham Stewart's claim that the plan is actually good for the environment because using fossil fuels in the North Sea negates the need for foreign gas, friends of the SFOE Scotland accused the UK government of sticking two fingers up to climate scientists and energy experts. By encouraging greedy fossil fuel companies to keep looking for more fossil fuels, the UK government is denying the reality of the climate emergency, said Freya Atchison, an oil and gas campaigner for the group, adding, instead of new fossil fuels, we urgently need a transition to an energy system powered by renewables and a mass rollout of energy efficiency measures to reduce energy demand. With the cost of living skyrocketing due to the volatile prices of oil and gas, it's obvious that the UK current energy system is completely unfit for purpose, serving only to make oil company bosses and shareholders richer, while everyone else loses out, the campaigner said. The crisis in Eastern Europe has sent energy prices soaring for households across Europe, but the Climate Action Campaign, Paid to Pollute, warned that licensing oil and gas fields in the North Sea will do nothing to alleviate the cost of living crisis. The plan is moving forward under the pretext of energy security, a campaigner for the group said in a video posted to social media. But another North Sea licensing round won't deliver UK energy security. He continued, the North Sea is an aging and oil-heavy basin. The bold truth? The UK has burnt most of its gas. Any new gas that is found won't be produced for years and years. As the UK Committee on Climate Change said earlier this year, it takes an average of about 28 years for oil and gas production to begin from the time an exploration license is issued. UK Green Party co-leader Adrian Ramsay called the news of the latest licensing round deeply distressing. The government's claim that burning ever more fossil fuels from the North Sea will help the UK meet its international obligations to become net zero by 2050 has no connection to reality, Ramsay said on social media. The new licenses are being offered nearly a year after grassroots campaigners were credited with pressuring Shell Oil to put out of a plan to drill in the proposed Cambo oil field in the North Sea off the coast of Scotland's Shetland Islands. FOE Scotland called on a Scottish First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, who opposed the Cambo proposal, to stand up to the NSTA's reckless plans to expand fossil fuels in the North Sea. A campaigner said these announcements risk locking us into a climate-destroying energy system for decades to come. Entrenching reliance on this volatile energy in places like Aberdeen and leaving people all across Scotland exposed to rocketing energy bills. Guardian wrote this headline saying UK offers new North Sea oil and gas licenses despite climate concerns. Guardian said the UK has opened up a new licensing round to allow oil and gas companies to explore for fossil fuels in the North Sea despite threats of a legal battle from climate campaigners. The North Sea Transition Authority has begun a process to award more than 100 licenses to companies hoping to extract oil and gas in the area. Almost 900 locations are being offered up for exploration. The process, which will run until the end of June, is the first since 2019 to 2020. The process was near annual before that, but it was put on hold by the government while it designed a climate compatibility check. However, the check has been criticized because it is only advisory and does not restrict authorities from granting a license. The licensing round also faces criticism as it will not solve Britain's short-term problems around potential gas shortages or sky-high bills. Climate campaigners at Greenpeace said the decision to launch the licensing round was possibly unlawful, and we will be carefully examining opportunities to take action. Since Liz Truss became Prime Minister, she has reopened the door to fracking in the UK and resisted calls from Labour to extend the windfall tax on oil and gas companies. The chief executive of Shell this week said governments may need to tax energy companies to fund efforts to protect the poorest people from soaring bills. The government argues the new licenses will boost Britain's energy security and create jobs, while the climate minister, Graham Stewart, said it would be good for the environment. Actually, it's good for the environment because when we burn our own gas, it's got lower emissions around its production than foreign gas, as well as supporting British jobs, Stewart claimed, speaking to BBC Breakfast. Philip Evans, an energy transition campaigner for Greenpeace UK, said, "Yet again, this government's energy policy benefits fossil fuel companies and no one else. supporting the oil and gas giants, profiteering from the energy and climate crises, ignores the speedy solutions that are best for the economy, for lowering bills, and for the climate. Experts have repeatedly made clear that we need warmer, energy-efficient homes and a big push for cheap, homegrown, renewable power. Yesterday, the IMF explained yet again that any delay to decarbonization makes it much more expensive. New oil and gas licenses won't lower energy bills for struggling families this winter or any winter soon, nor provide energy security in the midterm. Scotland's First Minister Nicola Sturgeon said there has to be a transition away from oil and gas and accused the UK government of haphazard planning for energy. Speaking to BBC Breakfast before the SNP party conference in Aberdeen, she said, "In terms of new licenses, I have been very clear that within the context of that just transition, we've got to subject any decisions about further exploitation of oil and gas to the most stringent climate checks." She added, "I worry right now that what we are hearing from the UK government is just a continuation of their haphazard planning about energy."
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we are going to be asking a question. That question is regarding whether the religious responsibility of Amr bil Ma'ruf wa Nahi az Munkar, Amr bil Ma'ruf wa Nahi anil Munkar, whether it was an edict, a law that also existed in the previous religions or not. Somebody might take certain verses as a proof that, you know, this is something specific to Islam. We have a certain verse in the Holy Quran that says that you are the best of nations that has come out for mankind. You enjoin the right and forbid the evil. Right? Somebody might say that this verse kind of indicates that this act of enjoining good and prohibiting evil is specific to the nation of Islam. But when we take into context other verses of the Holy Quran, we see that this is not the case, you know. There are other verses of the Holy Quran which say that, you know, Amr bil Ma'ruf wa Nahi anil Munkar is something that, you know, existed, you know, in other religions as well. For example, in the following verse of the Holy Quran, we read the following: Laysu sawa min ahli al-kitab ummatun qa'imatun yatluna ayati al-layli ana al-layli wa hum yasjudun yu'minuna billahi wal yawmil akhir wa ya'muruna bil ma'ruf wa yanhauna 'anil munkar. In this verse of the Holy Quran, God says a portion of the ahli kitab, the people of the book, they believe in God in the hereafter, and they enjoin the right and they forbid the evil, right? This is a verse that indicates that yes, this law, it exists in the other religions as well. Or the Prophet Luqman, in his advice to his son, he said the following: Ya bunayya, aqim as-salat wa'mur bil ma'ruf wanha anil munkar. He said, oh my son, pray and establish the prayer, enjoin the right and forbid the evil. This is another verse that indicates this was something present in other religions. Also, in the Quran, we read that one of the reasons that the Prophet Dawood and the Prophet Isa, alayhi wasalam, they cursed the children of Israel, was one of the reasons they did not pay attention and did not give importance to this act of Amr bil Ma'ruf wa Nahi anil Munkar. We read, لُؤِنَ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا مِنْ بَنِي إِسْرَائِيلَ عَلَىٰ لِسَانِ دَاوُودَ وَإِيسَى ابْنِ مَرْيَمَ ذَلِكَ بِمَا عَصَوْا وَكَانُوا يَعْتَدُونَ كَانُوا لَا يَتَنَاهَوْنَ عَنْ مُنْكَرٍ. Right? They were cursed by these two prophets, these great prophets. Why? Because they did not prohibit the evil. One of the reasons why they were cursed. Right? So this was a edict, a law in other religions as well. And you know, it's very unfortunate that in today's society, right, in specifically in the West, and then because of that, obviously because Western culture and Western customs have kind of prevailed over the totality of all humanity today, this has become something which people don't give importance to. You know, nobody wants to interfere in other people's business and interject their opinion into other people's affairs, right? And this is kind of contrary to the religion, actually the other religions that that are prevalent in the world today, not just Islam. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at whether the injunction of Amr bil Ma'ruf wa Nahi anil Munkar was prevalent in other religions or not. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.